Life requires a lot of creative adaptation, and sometimes it's not always the fancy stuff that makes it worthwhile. The little adjustments and experiments we make along the way can add a lot to existence. Fellowship members Connie and Peter Roop, who write children's books, are working on one right now about happy accidents. Here's an excerpt. Do you like chocolate chip cookies? Until 1930, no one had ever tasted one, writes Connie. Ruth Wakefield was making dark brown chocolate-flavored cookies for guests at her hotel, but discovered one day that she was missing the powdered baker's chocolate. What could she use instead? She did have semi-sweet chocolate in a block, and so she tossed chunks of it into the cookie dough. After all the pieces were chocolate, Ruth thought that the chunks of semi-sweet chocolate would melt and turn the cookies a nice brown color and give them an even chocolate flavor, just like the baker's chocolate would. Well, the chunks of chocolate melted, but they did not blend into the dough. Oops. Chocolate chip cookies were created by accident. I can't wait to read this next book of Connie and Peter's. I thought about this great story, which is considered urban legend by some and cold hard fact by others. You know how it goes. I thought about it when I went to see the Matisse as printmaker exhibit at the Payne Art Center in Oshkosh. Matisse's prints weren't created by accident exactly, but so many of them were the result of experimenting boldly and seeing what resulted. Like Ruth Wakefield, he was wise enough to recognize when he had created something wonderful, whether or not it was precisely what had been originally intended as the final product. One of the most famous artists of the 20th century, Henri Matisse, who lived from 1869 until 1954, was a painter, sculptor, draftsman, and printmaker. The collection that's now visiting the Payne brings Matisse's prints out of the shadow of his more celebrated paintings and sculptures by highlighting the full range of his printmaking techniques. There are more than 60 pieces of artwork on display, including etchings, monotypes, aquatints, lithographs, and lino cuts. It is truly amazing to see how deeply engaged he was in so many creative vehicles, even working on them simultaneously, understanding that each medium offered unique artistic possibilities and challenges. His practice of drawing with scissors, we learned about that in the story earlier, is an example of one of the forms that he explored more towards the end of his life. But the exhibit is far more comprehensive. The Great Room of the Payne is arranged to tell a story about his life and work, starting with some of his very first prints and taking visitors through virtually all of his productive years. I was there with about 15 people from the fellowship, some of you here today, and we had a really great docent. Christine stopped us in particular at a series of images about halfway around the room, and then we all crowded around. Even if you haven't seen these exact prints, she said, they might look familiar, because they were a sort of set of fanciful blueprints for another project that he did later. In fact, Matisse often used prints and other two-dimensional media to work through ideas for sculpture. Marble and other sculpting materials didn't come cheap, and they demanded a slower work process. And so he found these other ways to hone his ideas and develop pleasing shapes and lines. Well, we all looked at the images that Christine pointed out to us. We couldn't believe it. How could these be mere doodles? They were so wonderful. I'm going to show you what I mean, and here is where you'll see some of the nudity. Aren't they great? Just all by themselves, without even knowing what the sculpture might look like? I think a mark of true genius might be to be able to recognize a sketch, some mere doodle, as art in its own right. I ran all this by a high school friend of mine named Annie Murphy, who is a very well-known comic artist in Portland, Oregon. And she started nodding her head immediately. She told me that she knows a lot of cartoonists and comic artists who love their pencils. Pencils are what they call the first draft of the drawing. But once they ink it over so that the lines are darker and smoother, they feel it becomes too static. She wrote to me, "While a finished clean line is one that is desirable for the market, the artists themselves, ourselves," she corrects herself, "often feel like their drawing has lost some of its life in the process between quick, fluid sketch and intentional, methodical line. Because of this, and being a compulsive archivist," she says, "I always make a Xerox copy of my pencils before inking them. And I often like that version best." I wonder which of these Matisse liked best. This first image, with simple black and white lines, nothing more, nothing less. Or this one that risks a little bit of color. Or how about this more vibrant one? This is the final version of the image that he created and the one that Marty talked about in our call to gather. Isn't that great? But let's look back at the earliest, plainest one. It doesn't need to be completed with color because it is already complete. I think Matisse's lesson for us today is to enjoy the experiments and to recognize them as beautiful too. Rough drafts in their own way can be complete. We should be sure to notice the surprising value of what at first might only have been intended as a building block. I have seen couples overlook this during their engagement. As we start to wind down the summer wedding season, I've been thinking about how people who are planning to marry can inadvertently impoverish their relationship by focusing so much on the end goal of the wedding that they neglect the stepping stones that could actually help assure a happy marriage. Recently, I was watching Say Yes to the Dress. Have you seen this show? If you're willing to admit that you have, will you just raise your hand? I'm curious. A few of you, wow, there's some highbrow folks in here. All right. Well, each episode documents real-life brides on the hunt for the perfect wedding dress, for their perfect day, which will, of course, guarantee a happily ever after ending. I'm not exaggerating, I'm actually quoting. So there's always much suspense. Will the mermaid-shaped skirt look good? Will her conservative mother approve? And then the bride-to-be always ends up saying yes to some dress. As a great act of due diligence, I watched about 4 episodes in a row just to make sure it didn't evolve into something meaningful. Spoiler alert, it did not. I found myself wishing that these brides could embrace their wedding preparation the way that Matisse approached his art, by fixating less on the end goal of a perfect wedding slash life, and more on just experimenting with form and function. Just like Matisse knew that spending time and energy and honor on his prints would help with the marble eventually, I think that taking seriously the less showy details of life can forecast a successful marriage. They don't guarantee, but they do help. Art and relationship both benefit from techniques that require honing. So we should fiddle around with what might work in the art studio or in making a shared life. Good partnerships are nurtured as we practice responding to everyday opportunities to be good to one another. Little relational doodles, like negotiating who should not be spoken to before that first cup of coffee. Or how best to reconnect after a bout of work stress. That's going to be more important in a marriage than a dress with the right amount of lace. The wedding industrial complex can make it easy to forget this. For example, one bride on Say Yes to the Dress really took it to the next level, as they say, by saying yes to a $26,000 dress. That's 26 and three zeros. And then she said to the camera that making such a purchase was like finding her soulmate. It's kind of funny. There are no fiancés on this show. The men, and these are all heterosexual partnerships represented, the men have been replaced by the dresses. And as someone who officiates weddings as part of my job, I take issue with this for a few reasons. But one of them might surprise you. I'm not entirely comfortable with the idea of soulmates at all. And I know I sound like a crank, but hear me out. The New York Times recently highlighted a study published in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology, in which researchers gave married subjects a quiz involving common sayings that implied unity, like the idea of being made for each other, or a journey, such as, look at how far we've come. And then they asked the couples to recall conflicts or celebrations in their relationships, and then to rate their overall relationship satisfaction. It might not surprise you to learn that the science of romance isn't incredibly romantic. The research suggests that believing in soulmates or destiny, this idea that there is exactly one person who you were absolutely put on this earth to find, can and probably will backfire. There is research that shows that people who believe in destiny put less effort into working through relationship conflict. Here's how it can go wrong. If we are soulmates, someone might think, then nothing will go wrong in my relationship, and it will be easy and beautiful all of the time. And that, of course, is a problem, because when a conflict arises, the fact that there is any conflict at all can cause the destiny believer to question whether the current partner is actually their soulmate. And then they're more likely to give up on working it all out. In fact, says this study, we have pretty clear evidence that people who favor the journey idea have stronger relationships. When conflicts arise, they are better at dealing with them, and they have higher marital satisfaction, and they're even less likely to divorce. I don't know anything about his love life, but in the art realm, I think Matisse fully embraced this idea of a journey. He lavished his best attention on his etchings and sketches and prints. He saved them carefully. He valued them for where they got him, like to his sculpture and paintings. He used them to help with those. But he also treasured them for the precious works of art they already were. This mindset can even be helpful after a relationship has ended. Someone I happened to chat up recently at a wedding rehearsal in another state told me that not only did he not regret his divorce, but he didn't regret having had that whole relationship, in part because it brought into his life his wonderful children. It was not an easy divorce, but I really admire that he didn't cast off the first partnership as some kind of a damaged prototype not worthy of esteem. He even spoke lovingly of it and expressed appreciation for some of the ways that he was able to grow in his relationship with his former spouse, because as he put it, I got a lot of life lessons for next time or for the time after that. I guess for him, his first marriage was like that chocolate chip cookie. It was worthy, even if the end point wasn't quite as planned. Or like some of the lovely Matisse images we've looked at this morning, beautiful in their own right, even if they were only little rough drafts. I emerged from the Payne's Matisse as Printmaker exhibit, and it helped me look out at the world with new eyes. Isn't that the point of seeing art? Sometimes a carefully cultivated garden yields different results than originally envisioned. Have you ever realized you planted the wrong thing? Maybe the wrong thing was labeled? But the flowers are still lovely, the produce tasty, the peaches still worth a poem, like in one of our readings. This summer, when my spouse Amy and I were driving her belongings up to Appleton, a poorly marked construction detour deposited us onto a long, meandering country road in the rural South. It was a beautiful stretch of scenery, emphasized by the first hints of a pink sunset, and we'd never have encountered it otherwise. A happy accident, indeed. What are the ways that your own detours, doodles, or drafts have been great works of art?